Welcome to Worlds Apart. The Bible's command that the son shall not bear the iniquity of the father and vice versa doesn't always apply in politics, but in the case of the recent elections in the Philippines, it seems remarkably relevant. The May vote helped not just one, but two political dynasties to return or stay in power, despite their rather contentious legacies. Why is family politics so attractive to Filipinos? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Eris Arogay, political science professor at the University of the Philippines, Diliman. Professor Arogay, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Filipino politics over the last couple of years wasn't boring at all, but even by your rather boisterous standards, I think the latest elections produced rather remarkable results. We have the son of an ousted and disgraced leader, often described as a brutal dictator, being chosen as president-elect, and the daughter of a pretty controversial outgoing president, also often described as a dictator, now being elected as vice president. This is an amazing ticket. I don't think we have seen anything of the sort in recent years in global politics. What does it say about the aspirations of Filipino voters?
Well, we did not just elect a president and a vice president coming from two of the most powerful political families in the Philippines, but they were elected overwhelmingly with a majority mandate. The latest count is that both of them almost got around 58% of the vote. And in our system, we don't have a run of elections that assures a majority mandate. We only have a plurality system. So this is the first time that a president and a vice president has been elected by a majority since democracy was restored in 1986. And for that majority mandate to be earned by two children of former presidents makes it really an astounding electoral outcome. It seems like the majority has spoken, but we know that, as you have said, this electoral campaign has been very polarizing and toxic at the very least.
You mentioned that it's quite astounding. It's astounding not only because of the solid numbers that they got, and it's pretty remarkable in this day and age when approval ratings around the world are pretty low. People have very, very little trust in politics worldwide. But what is even more astounding is that you know, this restoration of democracy that you mentioned actually happened after the ousting of the father of one of the elected leaders. So how do you explain this very remarkable reversal of political fortunes?
Well, in the first place, we did not see Marcos Jr. and Sara Duterte go head to head. So instead of competing with one another, which would have been altered the outcome, and I do think that Sara Duterte might have the advantage here simply because she's the daughter of the present or the outgoing president. But because they did not compete, they even what I call cartelized themselves. They formed what I call a dynasty cartel, a cartel of dynasties with support from another former president who's also an offspring of a previous president, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, who forged the alliance. So basically, you have this cartel of dynasties saying that we're not going to compete with one another, unlike before. We're going to team up and therefore really band together and ensure that there will be no competition.
I know that under your system, and you already mentioned that, the president and the vice president are elected separately, even though Marcos and Duterte Jr.'s campaigned under the theme of unity. I think they even called their political pairing unity. Do you think this semblance of unity or them staying on one page will remain once they get to the very tedious and sometimes very contentious business of governing?
Right. There have been doubts because, as I've said, dynasties have not cartelized like this before. There are a few coalitions, but normally those coalitions don't really last long because there's no credible commitment to stay the course, simply because politics is a winner-take-all thing in the Philippines. So it means that if you're the one ruling, then you can simply say, I'm not going to share power. Right. But if this cartel, this alliance between the Marcoses and the Dutertes somehow gets reflected throughout the next 6 years, this I would even call promiscuous power sharing would even mean that perhaps it would be Sara Duterte that will run in 2028 with another Marcos as a running mate. And then they will just switch. And this will happen for years and years simply because the dynasty cartel will solidify. However, we do know that Filipinos get tired of the same brand over and over again. And I think this is the beauty of democracy. Filipinos can then choose other brands, especially if they don't perform well.
Now, speaking about brands, both Bongbong Marcos and Sara Duterte are very colorful personalities. And I think they walked somewhat similar political paths, not only in terms of their family legacies, but also in terms of their governing experiences. Both got their taste of governing regional or mayoral governing fairly young, in their early or late 20s. So they bring something to the table apart from their family names as well. Is it fair to paint them only as heirs to influential clans, or do they have something to show on an individual basis?
Right. Marcos Jr. became governor of a province up north, while Sara Duterte became mayor of the city in which she replaced her father, the current president, Rodrigo Duterte. So they had local government experience, although in comparison with their parents, I would say that they still have to prove their mettle, that they will still have to get out of the shadows of their parents. And I think part of getting out of that shadow is really are they just going to be clones of their parents, or are they going to do something different? Are they just going to mimic, or are they going to be a different kind of a dynast, something that will modernize the country and move the country forward? If their slogan is really unity, I do think they have to do more than simply copy paste from their fathers.
Well, I don't know about you, but I've been fascinated by Sara Duterte, and from what I've read of her, she's a pretty rebellious personality. She described her own relationship with her father as a love-hate one. She defied him on many occasions, even though he himself invested in her education and saw her as, you know, as a very bright child. What about Marcos Jr.? How would you characterize his relationship with his immediate and broader family?
Yes, let us remember that President Duterte wanted Sara Duterte to run for president. That was supposed to be the original plan, but Sara Duterte settled to run for vice president. And she has not had a very good relationship, even with the allies and the party of President Duterte. And this is why she somehow wanted to chart her own course. And aligning with the Marcoses and Gloria Macapagal-Arroyo was more like an initiative of Sara, that I'm going to chart my own political path on my own. I may be a Duterte, but I'm not just going to be under his shadow. Marcos, on the other hand, is a bit different because, in my own take, I do think this presidency is not just about Bongbong Marcos himself. This is about the dynasty, the Marcos dynasty, ruling the country. So because the elder sister is a sitting senator of the Republic, his son is going to be a member of Parliament of the House of Representatives. So we see the dynasty occupying certain positions, solidifying their legislative support, propping the family even. So I think that's the big difference. Sara might be more of a lone wolf, while Marcos Jr. will be ruling on behalf of House Marcos.
But he will still be doing that, ruling or governing, depending on your point of view, political point of view, I guess, with the popular support. He didn't just inherit that. He had to win it at the polls. Do I get it correctly?
Yes, but because he campaigned using authoritarian nostalgia and fantasy. Mm-hmm. So and the network of disinformation and propaganda has been built since he ran for vice president in 2016. That was relentless. Mm-hmm. And not even the other campaigns was able to catch up, because the other campaign simply started last year. Well, Marcos Jr. and the Marcos family has been planning this, because if the Marcoses really want to grab power, they could have run in 2016 against Duterte. They could have run in 2010 against the son of Corazon Aquino. That would have been a battle for, that would be thriller in Manila. Mm-hmm. The son of an Aquino versus the son of a Marcos. But we didn't see that. They bided their time. They waited for the right opportunity. And in the end, President Duterte's governance, populist, authoritarian, paved the way for a Marcos Jr. presidency.
I've heard many Western commentators accusing Marcos Jr. of being extremely populist and, you know, making promises that he may not be able to fulfill, specifically when it comes to the pledge of decreasing living standards, decreasing living expenses rather, and increasing living standards. Given that food and fuel prices are rising all around the world, can his government deliver on the promises that they made?
Right. That is the challenge. In the Philippines, in Philippine politics, we have a saying, it's easy to run and win. The more difficult part is governing. So Marcos Jr. is transitioning from Marcos Jr. the candidate to Marcos Jr. The ruler or the governor. So this means that he set up for himself high expectations by making all those glimmering promises of lower rice prices, of jobs, of infrastructure. And the Philippine economy is in heavy decline. We had the steepest decline in Southeast Asia. And guess what? The outgoing Duterte administration is already saying that the only way to recover is new taxes. So that's going to be a challenge for Marcos Jr.
Okay, well, we have to take a short break, Professor, for the time being, but we'll be back to this fascinating discussion in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Back to Worlds Apart with Aris Arogay, political science professor at the University of Philippines, Diliman. Professor, before the break, we discussed primarily domestic implications of the May vote, but for many of our international viewers, the most interesting question is that of the Philippines' geopolitical orientation, because for decades, your country has been a close geopolitical and military ally of the United States, something that may have started changing under President Rodrigo Duterte. Do you expect more of the same under the Marcos Duterte Jr. team?
Let us remember, if we look at previous Philippine presidents, with the exception of President Duterte, each of the Philippine president, including Ferdinand Marcos Sr., tried to hedge between great powers in the region, notably the United States, China, and even other countries. So this is the default position of any new president, with the exception of Rodrigo Duterte, who instantly pivoted to China and almost abrogated the visiting forces agreement with the United States. A Marcos Jr. presidency, and we've seen some hints of that with him meeting with officials from the United States, from China, from other countries, Japan, et cetera. Marcos Jr. doesn't have the personal baggage, unlike Rodrigo Duterte, and has actually not threatened the Mutual Defense Treaty. On the other hand, we also know that Marcos Jr. has very close relations with China. When he was governor of his province, he set up a consulate of China in his home province. That's how he wanted to be close to China. So I think what will happen here is that the Marcos Jr. will try to do a delicate balancing act. But as we will see, this might change in the coming years, depending on how that hedging will be successful or not.
Now, Professor, you mentioned before that Marcos Jr. comes to power with no prior geopolitical baggage. But as far as I understand, he has some outstanding legal issues with the American justice system. He and his mother defied a court order asking them to pay $353 million to the alleged victims of human rights abuses during his father's times in office. How do you see this case progressing from now on? Do you think it may be reopened, or do you think it may be forgotten?
Right. When U.S. President Biden called Marcos Jr., I doubt whether that was one of the topics that was discussed. I do think that what will happen here most likely is that Marcos Jr. won't be treated as Marcos Jr. A citizen, but Marcos Jr. as head of state, and therefore will be granted sovereign immunity. And this will allow him, for example, to visit the United States, something that President Duterte was not able to do. He's the only Philippine president that has not visited any country in the West when he was president. The most Western frontier that he visited is actually Russia. So this makes Marcos Jr. have a bit more flexibility. And despite this case, I do think that the United States will not sacrifice its strategic interests in the Philippines and in the region over this case.
Well, Professor, I agree with you. I think history knows quite a few public figures, from Nelson Mandela to Narendra Modi, who were once banned from entering the United States. And once Washington found some political expediency, those restrictions were lifted. But I think there is a difficulty in this particular case in that it's simply so massive. I mean, the Marcos Sr. regime was accused of such atrocities that forgetting about those alleged crimes at this point of time may not reflect very well on the United States and the Biden administration, which supposedly places human rights concerns at the center of its policies. I understand that the Marcos family may welcome that decision, but do you think the United States politically can afford to do that?
The function, the factor that needs to be monitored here also is U.S. domestic politics. We know that Biden will be up for re-election, and that the Democrats hold on both houses of their Congress is also precarious. So let's say Trump wins again, or a Republican politician, that will somehow even massage the case even more, and won't give in to the human rights democracy push that the Biden administration has been doing. The call of Biden to Marcos Jr. for me was very symbolic, because I think the United States really messed up when it didn't reach out to President Duterte when he won in 2016. They thought that, well, the Philippines is an old ally, so it wouldn't stray far. But we, Duterte has shown that it could. It could conduct an independent foreign policy. So they're very careful with how they're dealing with Marcos Jr. at present.
But on the other hand, Professor, President Duterte, as you said, threatened to walk away from the visiting forces agreements a couple of times. But at the end of the day, he didn't. Why do you think he didn't?
It's luck, mainly because of the pandemic. We must remember that the Philippines has had one of the worst pandemic responses in around 2020, 2021. And when the Biden administration took over, and this allowed an opening for the U.S. to reach out to the Philippines and ask for what it needs, that the Duterte administration and Duterte himself even said in one of his weekly addresses that I'm not gonna hostage the VFA if they give vaccines. And that's what the US actually did. It was a lost opportunity for China because China just kept on selling us vaccines rather than really competing with the Philippines for that response. And this is why Duterte has stopped with this anti-US rhetoric and has actually started invoking the arbitral ruling against China in his last 2 years of office.
All throughout this discussion, we've been sort of touching on this very delicate choice that Manila has to make between Washington and Beijing. And Marcos Jr. already described Manila's relationship with Washington as, quote, very important. But at the same time, he also said what you said, that his country will have to walk a very, very fine line between China and the United States. In your view, what would represent this optimal balance as far as the Philippines are concerned?
Oksana, I think it's what every Southeast Asian country tries to do. And that is rely on the United States for security and defense, while at the same time relying on China for economics and for trade. This decoupling is precarious, meaning other Southeast Asian countries have failed in their attempts. And the Philippines is not used to this because for the longest time, its economy was also pegged with the US and the West. So therefore, this is a challenge for the incoming Marcos Jr. administration. While the Duterte administration and the President Duterte has opened the line with China, Marcos then will have the challenge of maintaining it and expanding it, but not to somehow intimidate or somehow give a signal to the United States that it is going to undermine its security obligations on the Mutual Defense Treaty because of closer economic relations with China.
US President Joe Biden has just wrapped up his Asian visit, during which he made a lot of lofty speeches and didn't hide his intention to build an economic bloc, an Asian economic bloc against China. Would it be fair to say that at this point, the United States needs the Philippines more than the Philippines need the United States?
You wouldn't hear Washington admit that because on the other hand, pundits in Washington would even say that this is an asymmetrical relationship because the Philippines.
They would say that about any country. The United States is the only country in the world that whose interests are worth considering.
Right. But I do think that they saw that even the most pro-Western country in Southeast Asia could drift away. Mm-hmm. And that enabled the US to somehow pay more attention to the region. But the skeptics in us are always saying that the US is always like this, but it tends to say that, oh yes, we're in Asia, you're very important, but they don't walk the walk. If you look at how the funds that are coming in, where the money is going, it's not going to Asia. Even if their strategic competitor is in the region and not somewhere in the Middle East or elsewhere.
Well, that leads me to my next question, because I know that your country has just signed up to this new Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is supposed to be some sort of an alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative. But unlike the Chinese, the Americans you know, they're offering a lot of, again, lofty speeches but about values and what have you, but very little in terms of material benefits, you know, preferential market access, loans, infrastructure, what have you, everything that the Chinese are ready to provide. What are the potential benefits for Manila in this new U.S. led economic grouping? Because you mentioned before that there has always been this bifurcation of relying on the United States for the military support and on China for the economic support. Now that you have signed up to this new economic, even though it's very abstract grouping, would you have to sacrifice some of your economic relationship, economic ties with Beijing?
Under the Duterte administration, its primary economic program is what we call an infrastructure program called Build. Yes, we just repeat Build three times. Marcos Jr. has pledged to continue this. And in fact, it's a good pledge because only 10% of the BRI projects that links with our Build program has been implemented. And this is because of the bureaucratic delays on the Philippine side, more than on the Chinese side. However, I do think that because there's still a grave need for infrastructure, there are still gaps. But at the moment, Oksana, if you would look at who really supports infrastructure programs in the Philippines, it's not really China or the US, it's actually Japan. So Japan has been pouring in a lot of grants and aid and loans on infrastructure, more than the United States, and definitely more than China. So I do think that if this Indo-Pacific economic framework will work, it must not be just purely seen as the US pouring in money in the region, but it would really need to be a bit more multilateral on that, because at the end, ASEAN countries like the Philippines are very distrustful of being asked to choose between the US and China. So therefore, middle powers like Japan and others might become more palatable to ASEAN countries who's afraid of being crushed by these two superpowers.
Now, speaking about Japan, while President Biden was in Japan, there was also a lot of talk about a hot conflict similar to the one between Russia and NATO over Ukraine erupting in your part of the world. How high is a threat of that in your view?
Well, before the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the flashpoint in Southeast Asia and in the South China Sea and the East China Sea has always been there. I can distinctly remember that the threat was in the Korean Peninsula, in Taiwan, in the East China East China Sea territorial dispute and the South China Sea territorial disputes. So you have all these flashpoints, and therefore anything could happen if the tensions are not managed carefully. So therefore, I do think a lot of countries in ASEAN, including the Philippines, are very wary of this strategic competition, because in the end, small states like the Philippines and its neighbors in ASEAN are going to be victims in this chess game.
But what exactly can you do on this front? Because I'm sure you heard President Biden's latest announcement that the United States will intervene to defend Taiwan militarily. And even though there are various interpretations of that statement, I'm sure it was taken with a lot of apprehension in your region, especially considering that the Chinese Navy, as we know, is larger than the American Navy. If those two navies come to a clash, how far do you think it may go and how it may influence you?
Yes. Remember, of all the ASEAN countries, only the Philippines shares a maritime boundary with Taiwan. So if a flashpoint conflict in Taiwan will happen, of all the 10 ASEAN countries, it is the Philippines that's going to be pulled in immediately. And therefore, I think the Philippine interest here is to ensure that cooler heads prevail, to mobilize with other small countries in Southeast Asia through the ASEAN framework. We know that ASEAN is significantly challenged as of today, but we need to make ASEAN work in a looming conflict in the Asia-Pacific region, particularly in the Taiwan Strait. It's important that ASEAN be used as a platform, convening platform for all these superpowers, middle powers, and small powers to be able to use multilateral channels and manage the tensions. Because if not, I don't think it's in any interest of any country or stakeholder in the region for a conflict in the Strait to happen anytime soon.
Well, Professor Aruga, I think it's pretty evident after the very tragic experience of Ukraine, that the last thing this world needs is another war. Anyway, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you for this invitation, and thank you for featuring the Philippines.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you next time on Worlds Apart.